Ça va?
Oh, wow.
Rolling?
We are rolling.
Brilliant. Awesome.
Hi, guys. Thanks for coming out today. I'm really glad that Gloria Sutton can join us today to be in dialogue with Julian Hober. Julian here is up from LA for the day, and the Inward Turn runs through December 19th. Julian has a BA in Art History from Tufts and a BFA from the School of the Art of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, as well as an MFA from Art Center. And this is actually our third exhibition together, my favorite so far, and looking forward to hearing his thoughts on it. Gloria is the Assistant Professor of Contemporary Art History at Northeastern University and is a research affiliate in the Art Culture Technology Program at MIT. Her book, The Experience Machine, Stan Vanderbeek's Movie Drome and Expanded Cinema, was published by MIT in 2015, and this is one of the reasons that Julian and Gloria have kind of come to know one another and become interested in each other's practices, and so I'm looking forward to a lively dialogue, and we'll open it up to questions about 15 minutes before we end. Thanks.
Thanks, yeah.
And if you guys can turn your phones on,
thanks, Jessica. Thanks for having us. I'm really happy to be here. There are very few occasions that I would get on an airplane and come all the way over to see the show, but I've been working and following Julian's work for quite a while. And as an art historian, one of the things that I feel like happens to the way that we work on a much more slow glacial process in terms of how scholarship ossifies into publications and then the reception of that work. One of the lessons that I have always valued about Julian is thinking about sort of issues around reception and temporal qualities around both history and criticism. So one of the things as you see in the show around you, you understand the sort of sculptural and sort of historical acumen that he brings to his own work. What you may not know also simultaneously, he's one of the sort of sharpest critical minds I think working in the field today. It's one of the reasons why I come back over and over again with the studio and I twist his arm to have him come to Boston and speak to my classes. So even though there's this sort of Boston connection in our CVs, I would say the way that you and I sort of have come to know each other's work mostly was in and around Los Angeles, developing my research that was really looking at, again, when artists began to take up moving image in a moment alongside sculpture, painting, and other media, and in particular looking at what that term expanded cinema was. And in more specifically, I was interested in sort of methods and models of pedagogy, and this was something that Julian and I kept speaking about over and over again at certain moments in the studio practice. So this exhibition, I think, which is one of the, I would mark, you know, hyperbolically, I have no, you know, that's what we do as critics and historians. I think, you know, looking at things in a long-term way, this is an moment for him. It's a kind of restart on a lot of the questions that he's been asking, not just for himself and his own practice, which has been a long and interesting practice over the last 10 years, but simultaneously, this is the work, this is the show that begins to ask and answer the questions that we in the field of contemporary art history have been grappling with. And in particular, I just thought I would set out this sort of larger thing. One of the things that I was interested in was this way in which he calls it the inward turn, and I would argue that this, in fact, is the first show that we've seen Julian turn outward. And in fact, he's pointing to some of what I think are the most pressing questions around contemporary art and practice today. And one of them is this move that we're having away from sort of the assumptions of postmodernist art that you've actually articulated yourself in your own writing, from thinking about privileging the sort of imagistic and the textual towards a probing of the real and historical. And I see this sort of being mapped out historically here in the work. And then I'm just gonna throw out a couple of terms, because one of the things as historians of contemporary art, I'm always asked, how do we work on things that are so tethered to the new and the now, right? And one of the things that we deal with is terms. How do we begin to kind of, what is the language around which contemporary criticism can begin to put out there? What kind of methodologies do we use to unpack the work? And I think Julian is really pushing those questions for us. And the terms that come out from his own work, thinking about the abject, the archival, the mimetic, the notion of a precarious moment, and what troubles me most, I have to say, is the kind of ambivalence about a criticality. And this is the thing that I wanted to open the conversation with, thinking about how you think about certain terms and the language that you wanted to deploy in the show today. Or maybe I should start with a smaller question?
Yes, not a little smaller.
So maybe so then I raise the stakes really high, because again, this is where I think the level of discourse is happening in Julian's work. So maybe we'll start with this piece, maybe.
Okay.
Because in many ways, this, what you might not know, were you familiar with this work before, the Jessica Silverman show? So maybe you could talk a little bit about how this operates for you, because this is a huge move right here.
Right. So this piece, it contains elements that go back several years, but predominantly it's things that are made over the last year. In working on this show and starting on this body of work in the studio, you know, I work with a couple guys who are always at the studio, and we spend a lot of time just tinkering. And a lot of that tinkering and experimenting with materials and processes has produced a lot of what this show is. And what's on the shelf is a kind of, most of this stuff was on a shelf in the studio accumulating over the course of the year. And it was how we figured out how to do everything. And some of it was an experiment that just, well, it took on its own sort of quality, or it would be reminiscent of some other thing that seemed to have a resonant value. And so it would just sort of, everything gets shuffled onto the shelf and then referred to later in process. But this is really a sort of, it's called Form Index, and it explains all the information on how everything in the show is produced is available there. And the reason to make that move is I haven't done anything like that before in a show, whereas it's always in the studio.
Right.
And people come to the studio and, you know, there would always be people who come to the studio and like, oh, that's so interesting, what is that? It's like, oh, well, that's just part of the process. And it's incredibly one day, it's like, well, that's actually, maybe that should be shared. Maybe that's actually, in terms of content and in terms of what I'm after, producing a thought process rather than some specified goal is much more interesting. When you raise this question about, you know, what are the critical ambitions of the work, or is there an ambivalence about that? I don't want to say that there's an ambivalence, but often critical positions, as I see them staked out by artists, have their goal set out before the work is done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I can't quite do, right? That seems to me to put the cart before the horse, quite literally. And so, like, working this way tells me what the sort of critical element is. And the way bits of odd history seep into what should really be something practical, inevitably, where, like, elements of this come from, you know, art moderne, or elements of it come from, Michael Graves' sort of cartoonish postmodernism, and you just start seeing those things crop up in a process, and you say, oh, that. And in fact, these processes allow me to understand historical things better after I've developed something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe you want to kind of isolate a particular sort of sculptural piece that does that for you?
Yeah, sure.
Just to unpack a little bit about the process part of it.
So, one of the things in the show that really starts here, but is all over the show, is some of the sculptures in the show are molds of other sculptures. And the process of making the molds involves, you know, a lot of figuring and planning, and then hoping that you get the right result. And, you know, sometimes you pull something out of the mold, and, well, that looks like junk, but the mold looks amazing. And one of the things I was after, you know, sometimes I'm quite dumb in the studio, and if you think about the way most houses are built with post and lintel architecture, everyone relies on right angles. And I thought, like, well, how do you make a curve? How do you build something that has a curve, right? And it's just a simple problem to try to solve. And so I start looking at the stuff, you know, I'm driving to the studio, and I'm looking at, like, the Glendale Galleria. I was like, oh, this has this curved wall. How do you build that? And so the mold process is this process of trying to figure out how to make a curve. This piece in particular, down at the bottom, was about making like a single plane sort of wrap around. And in the process of doing that, you start, like, you know, Well, my studio building has a wall like that on the outside, and that's done by laying bricks a certain way. And well, that's like this building that's like a 24-hour fitness, and it's done with glass. And how do these things have the same structure? And then I start going and reading the history and trying to figure out like where those pieces come from.
Maybe you could share with them where you get the material acumen to actually make those molds, years that you spent.
Yeah.
I'm just, they're not privy to that too.
When I went to grad school at Art Center, I was actually doing stuff related to movies, and I was interested in doing special effects, and one of the professors there said, oh, we should get you a job in special effects, and the job I ended up with was working on Cramaster 3 with the Matthew Barney film. And there was a guy there who taught me to be a mold maker, and I ended up when that job ended, I ended up getting him a job working for Paul McCarthy, because McCarthy's best friend was one of my teachers. And so then I ended up working for McCarthy as well, and I ended up working as a fabricator for other artists and a mold maker at a very high level, because that was how I made my living. And then, once my own work started, taking off in a way that I could, just go to my own studio, that really just fully informed how the process worked for me. And a lot of other artists that I'm friends with and that I know, they design things and have ideas about things, but farm out the production. And almost all of my production is in-house, and I have a couple guys that work with me, and I always say we, because I kind of trained them how to do things the way I wanted to do it, and now we all kind of experiment together.
And then can you kind of talk a little bit about a broader sort of genealogy of references for your work at that time too, and thinking about how these things exist as tests or prototypes? Is there a language around them that then result in the kind of execution for these as one-offs? Once you kind of prototype something, I think there's a couple of different examples in the room of how these work both as singular pieces, but then as this kind of relationship between a perfect cast and one that's not.
I think there's two parts to the question. In terms of the set of references, in some ways I could just start like, spinning off hundreds of them.
Well, I'm here to guide you.
Right. But like, it's funny. As you're asking me this, one of the first things that jumps to my mind is Linda Benglis casting foam over the sort of piles of, whatever stuff with plastic over it to make the weird foam. I always forget the titles of those works, but they almost look like waterfalls of foam. These molds are made with the exact same materials and similar processes with taking a membrane and forming it to produce the, cast the foam in a certain way. And then we just take an impression off of that. Mm-hmm. But then there's also this thing that obviously goes to Rachel White-Reed, where like most of these objects refer to a kind of architecture. If you're casting a wall, if you're casting a model of a wall, well, the mold represents actually the space around the wall. And when you build a building, you erect walls, but you actually construct space. The molds represent the air in the room, right? With this relationship to Rachel White-Reed, how I make the decision about which ones sort of congeal into being finished works, it's pretty intuitive and subjective. It's the stuff sits around the studio for several months, and when things start like being productive, some of it, like that piece back there, I think for about 6 months, people would come to the studio and I would like take the different, it was originally in four pieces, and I would like rearrange them and say like, oh, look, it goes this way and it can go this way. And it's like, I was like, maybe I just built a toy, mm-hmm. right? And I think it was when I was exhausted with playing with it is what allowed it to sort of congeal into an object. But I still wanted to retain the play,
yeah.
right?
Well, so then maybe one of the things we had talked about with when we wanted to structure this talk around was this idea of productivity and thinking about production, both in the studio models, and there's long histories and art historical models about sort of from guild to kind of craft models, and then one about the kind of idea of coming in and working as a kind of anonymous, you know, studio labor, like you mentioned, your own history or starting off point is now too. So thinking about labor and productivity and measurement, and then thinking about the models that you've worked out here, which purport, as you have said, sort of, you know, going nowhere, right? In a certain way, a kind of like frustrated way of working that the results don't kind of work towards refinement or perfection in a certain way. And I just want to think about some of those models for you.
Well, when I think about going nowhere, I also think about the idea of you're always back where you started, mm-hmm. right? And that's not necessarily a lack of refinement. In some ways, that's sort of like continually polishing the same surface. Mm-hmm. In terms of labor, you know, I find myself often defending to people the value of artists who never put their hands on anything, right? Like, and I definitely think, like, you know, there's plenty of artists who just write something down or point to something and have someone else make it, and I absolutely endorse that. I just couldn't do it that way. And it's when I was in college, I remember I had to write a paper on something, and it became really clear to me that the reason I had to write this paper for this class was to prove to them what I knew. And I thought, like, well, that actually shows you that education is not for enrichment. It's to train you for duty, right? And I said that to my professor, and my professor said to me, "No, you write to figure out what you know." So, oh. And that's what I do. That's why I have to work in the studio, because that actually is how I figure out what a form is and what I know that. So all the paper forms there were the result of working on these sculptures, which are molds for that sculpture. And it's like you start working with something and it reveals a possibility, right? And then you keep going. For me, you know, I've accrued all these skills and they allow me to understand a history through materials.
So maybe one way to ventilate this question would be then to ask, then, you know, one of the other things that I think it's an ongoing conversation in your work is how you draw from other disciplinary practices, architecture, engineering, drawing, and drafting. How do you adapt those processes or those sort of disciplines and the vocabularies of those disciplines into the work here, too?
I mean, some of it's really through ignorance, right, where I don't know if this is how you meant it, but I think maybe I go in an opposite direction, that I see something in another discipline, and I'm like, oh, how could you ever do that? And then I go in the studio and tinker to try to figure it out, mm-hmm. right? And you know, I have some very specific ideas about the ways that other artists and other discourses have tried to sort of connect, say, design and art, that I tend to disagree with, right? Like, part of my thinking is, like, I think there are artists who make furniture and present it as a kind of, they call it social sculpture, mm-hmm. and it's kind of, but that's furniture, mm-hmm. that's not sculpture, that's sculpture. And I make a distinction because I think the way that the distinction is sometimes collapsed, some artists do that because they think that legitimizes design. That design in itself does not have, you know, sufficient standing. And I actually, after making enough chairs, I kind of realized, like, it's kind of harder to make a really great chair than to make a really great painting. You know, I mean, not harder, but it is on equal footing, right? So, you know, I try to respect the discipline and then also steal everything I possibly can from it to drag over to the art side. But I don't want to say that, like, what I'm doing legitimize, like, for me, the audacity of suggesting that, like, what I'm doing would legitimize architecture is hilarious, mm-hmm. right? But then there are artists who function that way.
Yeah, and then maybe moving on, maybe thinking about for me in particular would be a kind of way in which there's these utopian notions of built space or fantastic spaces or sort of liminal spaces, right? And that's one of the underlying themes, you know, in this project, right, was to kind of think about this concept of no place or going nowhere. And I wanted to throw this kind of thinking about the etymology of something like utopia, which is a literal no place, right? And so thinking about how this effort of yours, this, you know, this intense amounts of production, the intense amount of labor that goes into producing this, right, is to kind of frustrate a sense of linear progression or kind of a way of moving through a positivist notion of that we're going to actually develop something. So I wanted to kind of think about this notion of utopian efforts or fantasies about a utopian idea of no place and going nowhere.
Well, okay, so if the utopian idea suggests that there might be an answer to some of the problems, I'm not a believer in that sort of conceit, right? And there's four drawings over there of possible floor plans for the building, and that's like the first four. Maybe there's another half dozen coming. There's a couple more at the studio. Maybe it's an infinite thing. Maybe it will never be settled upon. For me, rather than the idea, you know, if you go for the idea of utopia, if you want to solve a problem, you've already sort of created a dominant ideology that says this is right. And I'm kind of not interested. I'm kind of interested in like being allowed to get it wrong over and over again for the purpose of being like, oh, well, I didn't know that, you know, or you know, on some level, it's just like when you see a shape that you haven't seen before, it's like, oh, the world is bigger than I thought it was.
But I'm going to press you a little bit because you're one of the most astute art historically informed artists I know. So when you say, "Oh, I'm done," this is sort of a blunt. I think it's a. I'm just going to call. You know. It's a little bit of a shtick, right? Because here you walk us through a complete history of sort of avant-garde from surrealism to Joseph Albers. I mean, everybody can. You're incorporating the kind of.
Yeah, but I don't say which one I like best.
No, you don't have to say which ones you like best. But I do want to press you a little bit to think about the dialogues that you enact in the work itself, right? A kind of arguments that wants to come out.
Okay, so modernism keeps wanting, you know, every time, every iteration, it's like, no, this is it. In fact, like in some ways, every sort of great modernist wants to say, like, I've solved it, right? And here we are, you know, many years after that conceit has evaporated, and you have the sort of pleasure and possibility of sitting back and saying, like, oh, none of you solved it. Solving it's besides the point, right? And in fact, you know, I do go back to psychoanalytic models a lot, but in some ways the most basic version of that is, you know, neurosis is the inability to tolerate ambiguity. And when you insist that you found the solution, that's an intolerance of ambiguity. And being able to mill through as many different historical idioms as possible and in fact find where they are in disagreement with each other and not have that produce fear, but rather produce sort of interest and possibility, that's a kind of rebuke of modernism and a kind of, like, if there's a critical effort for me, it's to reconcile these things that, you know, modernism and even postmodernism want to, you know, produce panic or a neurotic reaction.
Mm-hmm. And the other way you do that too is by this complete a kind of disavow of the medium specificity of modernism too, right?
Oh yeah.
We have paintings that are done. You know, maybe walk through a little bit about some of the ways in that has come out in practice.
And that's interesting that you bring it up because, like, and you started with this conversation about expanded cinema. You know, my first show was video. I actually like landed in art school on the assumption that like no serious artist would ever do one thing, right? And I feel like actually that idea of medium specificity has like come back in the last 10 years in a way that it never existed when I was in school and when I was learning. And, you know, I up until fairly recently, I had started to congeal in many people's minds as a painter, and I found that horrifying, right? Like, it was absurd, right? I was like, well, I make horror movies. What are you talking about? I'm not a painter. But with this show, you know, there's something, each medium sort of allows you to do different things, and why not take full advantage of it? And
or maybe to kind of, like for me, when this show was coming through, and we had sort of, you were sort of sharing bits and parts of it, I kept thinking about this idea of the Kuzanskunst work, with this totally encompassing work.
Right.
And it also falls into that lineage of utopian fantasies around something that would be a reintegration of the human senses to a contemporary actuality, right? This idea of a dystopian confusion of both spectacle and death, kind of all coming full circle into something, right? And it was one of the things that I felt like you were sort of working in terms of a spatialized way of bringing these works together. Like this kind of idea of a totalizing artwork, both internally thinking about the relationship to the body here, very visually laid out, and then the forms themselves being these sort of systems that are both like playing on the Klein diagrams or the Mobius strips, right? Systems that are both external and internal simultaneously.
Right, and the conceit of the project, this, you know, that begins at this idea of a pavilion, the sort of, the function of the pavilion would be, you know, in my mind, would be that people who would come to the pavilion would experience this kind of looping architecture, this kind of repetition of space, and that you could produce the experience of rumination, is the word that I use, right? And that the process of designing this building does the same thing for me in the studio, is to produce this practice of rumination in order to develop the thing. And the conceit and its result are the same thing, right? And so the show becomes all of the, and it's, there's other things that aren't even in the show that could have come into the show, that it's the generation of this, you know, it's the rumination and everything that comes from it. Every sort of part of the process is worth at least considering including into this framework, right? I don't have to throw anything away. As a utopian idea, it's like, if I sit down and ask like what I think the social function of art is, I get really frustrated. And but on some levels, like the easiest thing for me to go to is like it ought to give people more options. There ought to be more, and not options like, I mean, there's this postmodern problem, right, of like too many options is actually not freedom. Mm-hmm. But that I wanted to set up a situation in the studio for myself where anything fell within the rules. And so being able to make a show this way is part of that. And that is the utopia. I mean, if there is a sort of utopian model, it's like, let's make, Julian's going to make a world where everything is possible, right, within a framework.
So that's the,
I mean, that's the kind of the utopic conceit, if you want to get down to it. But that also should mean that, like, the things outside, like, Godard says this thing when he's writing about film, that, like, in the frame, you have to account for everything that can't be seen in the frame. Mm-hmm. You have to at least pay respect to the idea of everything that's outside. And so I'd like to be able to work that way, where, like, even if you're only looking here, you acknowledge that all that other stuff in the world exists, and there's, like, and you're not sort of destroying it by putting your frame here.
So what about this notion, then, of failure as a generative process for you?
Yeah, I think it's a way of speaking that one has to be a little bit careful about, because it's too easy to sort of turn that into fetishizing the mistake.
Right.
And it's more, you know, for me in my particular process, it's acknowledging that you don't know what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. Right? And that you, if something happens that was unexpected, that's not a problem, right? That's some other thing that you set down on a shelf, and you know, in the next couple months. Maybe it'll tell you what it was, right? And or if you're really lucky, it'll tell you right in the moment, right? And like,
so are you suggesting a kind of subjecthood for your objects? That they kind of have this, that's one of the things that I was...
Subjecthood for the object.
I mean, it sort of, it seems like you're getting into this dangerous territory where you want to kind of anthropomorphize them and that they're going to desire...
Well, I think that's like a really hip thing in contemporary art criticism right now.
We have thing theory, we have affect discourse, we have...
Object-oriented ontology. And look, in my mind, it's a literary device.
Yeah.
Not a philosophical proposition. You know, when you look into the abyss looks back into you. No, the abyss isn't looking, you are experiencing that idea, right? So, but what I mean, you know, I will say that, like, if I say, well, the object kind of tells me what it wants, what I really mean is I've constructed a complete enough idea of this thing on an unconscious level that, like, I can now intuitively respond to these objects and they start creating their own. And I don't know how that happens, mm-hmm. right? You do stuff in the studio and it's like, you don't have the answer to everything. And there are these moments where the work kind of like, you're like, oh, wait, that's smarter than me, right? That thing there. And it's smarter than me because it's got like five passes of me going over it, right? It's like...
Yeah. So let me throw something back to you that gets thrown, like critics right now, and I'll... Hal Foster's one of them. Many of them are writing this one. There's a lot of sort of hand-wringing happening right around this turn that we talked about, a way of the disavowal of the image and the text, a turn toward material history, right? He gives us two options, right? You can kind of go neo-Gramscian and kind of have the social art practice, or you can go the neo-situationist, right, and talk about image flows and kind of the way in which the derive and the drift and these other kind of strategies that have become adopted within contemporary practice. But the other point that I think the other warning signal he sends out is to kind of think about, he says something that, you know, what you talked about, this plurality of choice that artists have in terms of their repertoire or their references that they want to point to. He says, to, you know, that freedom is more like a whateverness and that, you know, that equality is more like indifference. So how do you avoid those types of, you know, I understand the way ambiguity functions for you. But then how do we avoid this idea that if you can pull from this entire repertoire of subjects, themes, and forms, you know, one of the consequences that there is no specificity or importance. There is no kind of hierarchy, right?
Right.
And I don't think that's...
No. Well, and also, like, I made the entire show color coordinated, right? like you have to be making pretty, like... I won't even allow, you know, I allow a little bit of green, right? Like, oh, but there's no blue, right? And so it's clearly, it's not just like an open field and everything is equal to me. But by contrast, you know, how to put this? If we're going to talk about this idea that precedes what Foster's talking about, it's almost as if certain painters would say, like, only a fascist would use blue. And I'd be like, well, blue is just not for the show, mm-hmm. right? That if you, in some ways, if you lower the stakes a little bit, there's more room to be surprised, mm-hmm. right? Like, I found, like, conceptual, like, nothing is more tyrannical to me than conceptual art and its history in Los Angeles through the schools, right? It's like, it's terrifying. Like, I went through school and you could not make a move without justifying every, like, and there was a moment where...
Can I nod to? There's a few folks that we recognize too, right, from our own.
there was literally moments where someone would say, oh, I did that because I liked that color and I thought it looked good, and they would apologize for it.
Right.
Right, and it's like, well, and I understand why we got to that place, but... that's too paralyzing in the studio. The answer is, and it's actually kind of an irony because so much of the conceptualist strategy was to get away from the sort of tyranny of subjectivity and the idea of the genius, right? And I don't want to fall into that problem. And at the same time, it's like I'm a specific person, right? And I have specific tastes and specific set of interests. Sometimes I move towards the autobiographical as an explanation. And sometimes just to sort of justify what my location was, and that's why these things pass through this location.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that I have an answer to that question that sort of provides a sufficient critical response to Hal Foster.
No, that's not our job.
Yeah.
I
would like to. I would love to.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, like, the same stakes in terms of, you know, right now it has to do with the kind of, I think, withering of criticism, right? Nobody wants to be critical, right? We don't want to say what's more important, what's more salient, right, in a certain way. And I feel like what I appreciate about your work is to kind of think about a different type of genealogy, right? Mm-hmm. For me, in contemporary art, and if you're looking at, thinking about the psychoanalytic or a kind of way in which other generative models for meaning production, how do we get away from Mike Kelly, Jim Shaw, and Robert Smithson as sort of being this trifecta of early points of reference and everything sort of coming and mediating through them, right? And I'm just sort of three figures that have loomed quite large in a range of practices. And it's not that I'm not interested in those practices and they're not salient or important by any means, but I wonder what new types of genealogies we can open up to or map on, whether you mentioned like Linda Bengalis, you know, there's other work that I think for you has been a kind of point of contact and condensation around, right?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, one of the most important exhibitions for me in terms of the formation of my ideas about art was the WAC show mm-hmm. at MoCA, because it was that moment where you realize that the different possibilities of material usage is like incredible, mm-hmm. right? It's totally expansive and limitless. And then
you guys are familiar with that exhibition, right?
This is Cornelia Butler's show on the history of feminist art from like 16 to 83.
That was at the Museum of Contemporary
at MoCA, right? Los Angeles, and it's a phenomenal show. The range of practices, but also this idea, and to me, this is like one of the great lessons of the 20th century: is that like nothing is uninflected, nothing is neutral. And no material is without its implications, and also that context can alter the implications of those materials. And so, like, we were talking earlier about Faith Wilding and the crocheted environment. Like, that's like, well, it's kind of huge for me in the construction of this stuff. The other thing about that show is, like, here you are, you walk in the museum, and here's a show of, I think it was like 90 artists, and I probably knew the work of like 8 or 9 of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people really like the new stuff, and it turns out that like there's this endless history that is buried, and you can just keep excavating, and mm-hmm. and then like you don't have to, you know, I don't have to like go to like a grad studio to find the next new thing. I can actually go back to like 1977 and find somebody that's gone.
Well, that's what I think is important in thinking about the, like I mentioned, the genealogies that you're mapping out to, because it's about activating a past. To me, that's the critical stake in the work, right? Mm. Is to kind of say, what am I going to point to in the past? And so, and I think that is a result, I mean, for me, it's a counter to the contemporary condition in which there's so much abstraction right now within painting, and especially photography. Mm-hmm. So there's a way in which, and especially a generation of contemporary photography and painting has been talked about like they're in direct dialogue, like we said, with Moholy-Nagy or Man Ray. But
right,
I would
right,
argue
right.
they want to bypass that messy enterprise of the 1980s and 90s of the Sarah Charlesworth, the Barbara Kasten, right? So there's a way in which, that's what I'm saying about activating certain mediations or histories, whether it's through exhibitions or galleries or affinities or, cultural history and material history. And
right,
I think
right, right,
that's
right,
what
right.
I sort of, that's the critical stakes of what I see happening here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... One of the really exciting, I mean, it's a little bit tangential from my own practice, but like one of the exciting things, I go to the book fairs and I dig through the books and you find these like little catalogs from like 1982, 1979, whatever. And like you flip it open and there's like 20 artists that you've never heard of, maybe one you have. And what's funny is like the last time I had this really, like a really sort of illuminating experience with this, I found this book from 1979 called African American Abstraction. And I'm like, who's Stanley Whitney? Mm-hmm. You know? And it, you know, there was a, just Melvin Edwards, and just a ton of artists that I found this book 5 years ago, and in the last 5 years, like, they've all sort of been revived. Mm-hmm. And like this is like the incredibly positive side of what the market can do, right? Is like, you know, it is track down these other histories, and it's like, you know, it's nice to rewrite mm-hmm. a little bit.
So maybe that's a good way to kind of open things up too. It'd be great to think about having you guys all hear the various histories and points that you came to the work, you know, to maybe kind of open up to questions or other comments or, yeah.
You know, this is how I've met your work. But I wonder, in your statement for the show, you spoke about a moment where you reduced your palette and the elements that you were working with. And the sculpture is very complex, but you can see that it's a straight line and where a straight line can go.
Right.
And you spoke about, you know, you reduced your color palette for this show. So I don't know much about your work beforehand. Did you have a moment where you thought, I'm cleaning the things that are on the, I'm reducing what I'm working with? Or had you been working towards that?
No, the thing with reducing to this like simple thing of going from like a curve to, or a straight line to a curve, that almost came of necessity because I didn't know how to do it, right? It was like I wanted to make complex curvilinear sculptures and I had to teach myself. And that entails, you have to start with the basics. I guess that was my natural assumption, was that you had to start with the basics. So I pared down to something really simple. Like, let's just make like a 180 degree curve on a straight plane. Like, can you do it? And you know, so, I mean, really, some of like what I do is built out of the dumbest foundation exercises. But that gives a kind of clarity to begin with. In terms of the color, I think there was just a point a few months ago where I was thinking about what the show is going to be, and I'm looking around the studio, and you know, the materials we were working with were pretty monochromatic to begin with. And I was like, well, this is kind of good. This is kind of working, and let's not stray too far from it. And it's also because from a design sensibility, you can sort of form a kind of cohesion in stuff that otherwise might not be through that kind of device. Yeah, no matter what kind of work I've been doing, it's always been part of it, and I don't always show them. There's like stacks more in the studio that haven't been shown, and a lot of them are just working drawings and ways of working out ideas, and you know, it's just faster, right? And especially when I work with these two guys, right? It's a form of communication with them.
And I kept arguing because I thought these things were the things that ventilated the practice.
Sure.
You know,
yeah. Exactly.
Open
right.
It up, because in many ways, when you see these tabletop sculptures or you see the forms, for me, I kept pushing you to think about, show me the math, like show me how we arrive at this in a certain way, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Gloria's the one who came to my studio and was like, so that's interesting, why don't we ever get to see that? And I was like, oh, well, shit, okay. Yeah, that would be interesting, come to think of it. And so some of these are literally sketches for the painting. Some of them were sketches for kinds of paintings that never got made because they didn't need to, or they didn't cut the mustard in that way, or they wouldn't have made the proper translation, but are interesting as drawings. Or the green one is actually a drawing from 2007, which I remembered was in my flat file because it is similar in structure to some of the stuff I was doing playing with string. And I realized, like, oh, right, I was trying to like describe a sort of undulating surface in the same way 8 years ago, and I had said it, you know, it was like, so, you know, it was just like, oh, well, I gotta like take the thoughts and sort of bring them out into space. And then, you know, the one on the lower right over there was literally me trying to figure out, there's a way to make a spiral operate inside of, inscribed inside of cubes. And I was trying to figure out how to do it. And literally the drawing is me trying to figure out how that kind of space works. And ideas about what this pavilion structure should be, you can't just have floating in your head. You got to get it on paper. And so that's, I mean, they're literally thinking.
Yeah, I read that as like the psychological part of the index, I guess. This is more physical part of the index.
Yeah. Well, but it's also the first step of translating the psychological into the physical. There is that one drawing that's like stuck in there as a contaminant that's like this fully rendered thing, which I ought to explain that particular drawing. A Klein bottle, it's a drawing of a Klein bottle, which is what a lot of these forms come from, which is a three-dimensional Mobius strip. It's
the Felix Klein bottle.
Yeah, it's a tube that turns in on itself, and it's like a three-dimensional Mobius strip. It's got a single surface, but a volume. And then attached to it is a breast. And the drawing is called, it's called the Melanie Klein bottle. Melanie Klein was a British psychoanalyst who really theorized that sort of all nurture and development focuses around the breast and breastfeeding. And I did 9 years of Kleinian analysis, and so it's too like rich of a joke not to make.
And also, I feel like what the drawings also do is, if you feel like there's the ambiguity in the work too, and you want to get a sense of humor and the kind of enthusiasms, I think this piece here and the drawings, like I said, sort of like are those moments that create some kind of ventilation or air.
Well, and they're also the stuff that's like that happens most quickly, right? It's just like you're doing stuff on the fly, you're not being too self-conscious in the process, and then you can edit later, but yeah.
Can you speak a little more about the body, the internal? We've been talking a lot about the architectural components, but talk a little more about the pieces in the back, the body.
Pieces, oh, you mean with
yeah.
The painting?
Yeah.
Well, I'm just trying to think about like which tack to take on this. Mitochondria in cells are evolutionarily, they used to be their own organism that was then absorbed into the cell. And it's like the cell is like a little house for this other organism, right? The mitochondria is an organism living in the cell. But then now they're unified, right? Like that's the most basic form of architecture, right? The mitochondria living inside of the cell. We all lived in a womb at one point, right? But then there's also like there's the very obvious thing where like, row houses all look like faces. And there's constant anthropomorphizing. We constantly are like building things to sort of recapitulate ourselves, right? And so, to me, the labyrinth in Greek mythology. It's a half man, half bull that lives in the labyrinth, and the gut is a labyrinth. And rumination, the word rumination comes from a description of it comes from the rumen, which is the cow's stomach. And they're like, it's all these connections. Like, as soon as you start looking for them, they're all there, right? And it just seemed really, I'm kind of against art that tries to separate the mind and the body, the thought and the experience. And it's a way to sort of keep those things integrated. Sometimes, sometimes, when you see art that's like connected to architecture, it's really like it's really cold, right? And really removed from experience and diagrammatic. And I kind of wanted to just get weirder than that, because that seems more true to life to me. Like my experience of architecture, that Adolf Loos thing I was reading this morning, that was like, what kind of, like if someone commits suicide, does it matter what kind of room they're in? And it's like, does it matter who the architect was? I was like, well, maybe a little, actually. He's saying it doesn't, but I think it kind of does a little bit. And it's like, it's a way to mix up those problems.
Yeah, one of the striking things about the show, I thought, is how transparent the process is, more than most shows I've seen. And I I don't know if I'm misinterpreting, but it seemed like somewhere along the way you decided to include like the negative space.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, like, going forward, once you decide to do that, like, now that you're self-conscious of that, do you make different molds going forward, or just leave that idea behind and kind of...
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like an I don't know, but hopefully I wouldn't do that kind of, like, weird oppositional reaction where I would say I can't do it now. You know, hopefully I've just like added another tool to my kit. I've always wanted to curate a show called Trade Secrets, which was just it was only fabricators and not artists, like and just show all the work of the fabricators and how they did things, because it's always so fascinating for sort of everybody. And you know, if people, you know, if anybody's like, oh, how'd you make this? Like, I'll always tell. I don't, like, none of it's secret because that's exciting. And hopefully I get to, like, just keep that as another tool, right? So, yeah, probably do it. I could probably repeat some of it.
Yeah. And that reminds me, I don't know if you guys have read Freeze from October, but Julia had a great essay in there thinking about this distinction between scholarship and enthusiasms, right? And sort of saying that it's not cool to be enthusiastic or to be a fan, and a sort of a reclamation, not so much of the amateur position, but in a way of working in the kind of enthusiasms for things, you know, and recouping that kind of idea, I think was a kind of really interesting argument that you made that I kind of see being borne out in a lot of aspects of this show here too.
Yeah, I'm not
he makes a bigger argument about appropriation and the way in which, you know, this idea, like sort of what I opened up with, right, that if we're sort of moving away from a certain orthodoxy, what methodologies are available to you, right, and what's in that, you know, thinking about the equivalent of that or the sort of cultural corollary would be sort of fan fiction for artists, right, taking and then adapting, right, that's the big thing, is sort of taking and referencing, but then sort of adapting and adding another layer.
Well, and rewriting, right? You know, like, you know, rewriting your own ending to the old history.
Right, and so many of these works I think of as narrative knots in many ways that move from things like something, like you said, of the mysterious and the kind of organic and even occultish, and then kind of the ribald to even mockery, and then also the bizarre and strange, right? That they all become sort of entangled in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's a comment over here. Sorry, did you?
I was curious if you feel misunderstood if people read this as like the last step on the journey of this work as like a provisional painting, and like if people were receiving it in that way.
I don't think that would be wrong even, because you know in installing the show, right? Like all this stuff came in boxes from the studio, and these aren't the shelves from the studio. We made sort of different shelves for up here because I still use the shelves in the studio. And you know, when he got here, I opened up the box and I composed this. And I didn't make an exact reproduction of how it was on, because the way it was on the shelf was like, you take things down, put it back up. I have an assistant who's such an obsessive aesthete that he would like arrange things. And so, you know, it is, right? It is in some senses, like it's absolutely composed. Like the paints are really like distributed in a compositional way. You know, I can't help myself. So it's not wrong, right? But it's not all of it. Yeah.
Do you think it could inform like the next show?
Jessica is guessing it will. I have gotten to know myself well enough not to make predictions until I'm like actually doing it in the studio, because I always start a show like, I'm gonna do this, that, and the third, and like by the end I'm like, oh, wow, none of that's in the show. So we'll see. But yeah, why not, right? I'm very pleased with how this thing came together. I love looking at it. I think it's great, whether or not. And sometimes it takes me like 5 years to get back to something like that, where I've done projects where like, oh, there's like a seed of something in there, and 5 years later, like then I'm like, oh, that's what that was. Now I can make 100 of them or whatever. Yeah. I can really like get it to spin.
It has this kind of boîte en valise effect, right?
Yeah,
but
it's
the internal processes, or the, you know, the kind of transparency of processes, rather than the ready-made or the object, right?
Well, yeah, that's, wow, okay. That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about the boîte en valise connection with that. That's great.
I mean, you're the one that's always, and it's funny because I always beat Julian up too because he loves to throw out Duchamp because of his own history of living in Philadelphia and going to the PMA and sort of doing this. And I was going to say, I'm not going to let you do that. In fact, and so I gave you that one.
Thank you.
Are there other thoughts, comments, or questions?
What about math and especially calculus? It seems like all of your curves are almost linear. Make them the greater frequency so they form curves. So
right.
It's very different. Do you have any CAD, use any CAD or use any formulas, you do anything mathematical when you do this, or is it?
Oh, there's a lot of math.
What?
There's a lot of math. I taught SAT math. And my grandfather was a mechanical engineer and a mathematician and, you know, really beat a lot of like mechanical drawing and I learned how to do all this stuff with a compass and ruler, like in that really old fashioned way, and so my grandfather taught me how to do that. And so that's like always been there, and I think that thinking gets me there. In terms of CAD, I don't have like a great facility with the software myself, but I work with a guy who does, and I sort of sit over his shoulder and I understand all the principles. And in fact, those string models back there were literally, because I wasn't good at the software and didn't have it on my computer and was at the shop, those developed literally out of trying to use the same methodology as CAD, but just with string and plywood and right, like pulling vectors across space. Because I didn't know how to calculate the trigonometry for one of those things, and I was like, well, we can just put nails and stretch a string and then measure the string. Yeah, calculus, I never got that. I did like really what they call applied calculus, which is kind of like the low level. But, you know, I understand the principles, and I also understand that like when you take a piece of fabric and stretch it over an odd form, you're doing the same thing as some of the computer programs where it's a series of vectors that put pressure on each other and create a form, you know, but then it's also like, it's also Fry Auto, you know, it's also
these like surrealist, strange shapes that are not sort of repeatable too in certain ways.
Right. And I do think about the connection between that sort of form and even like I think you could do a whole show about like Senga Nangudi and Frank Gehry. Like that would be an interesting show for me, mm-hmm. Right? Hi, Sarah.
I'm just wondering if because you think a lot about process, whether when you look out at a lot of the sculpture being made nowadays, whether you can tell whether it was designed on computer or initiated and designed and worked through physically in three dimensions.
I mean, I wouldn't say universally, but a lot of the time. A lot of the time you can tell. Yeah. I mean, you can tell from that Matthew Barney show that guy's never seen a computer, right? The Matthew Barney show at MoCA. He's never seen a computer, and it's kind of like the virtue of that work in a way. Sometimes you can really spot it. I think a lot of the work where it's really at the center of it is going to end up looking dated really fast, I mean, a lot of the architecture does. Where like it looks like an artifact of software, not like some other thing.
Can you imagine the point in the practice when it will enter back in video?
Oh yeah. I'm thinking about that a lot right now, and I hesitate to like talk about it too much because like I don't really know how I'm gonna do it, and you know. Computer animation has like bounced across my radar, and I'm like, is that the way? That would be too contemporary. You know, maybe we'll see. Yeah, but absolutely. I thought I was kind of good at some of the video stuff. I thought I did some okay videos. It'd be nice to get back to that.
So, maybe one more question, or if we have time. Yeah.
I was just curious. I look at a lot of these forms and can see them being like scaled up.
Well, Liz, I'm designing a pavilion, right? Like, it's supposed to be like a 300-foot long, it's supposed to be an airport terminal scale. But I actually, with those paper models, like, After making a bunch of them, I was like, wow, those would be really great as like cast concrete, steel reinforced, or I don't know if you guys have ever seen, I only discovered this really recently, is Perkirkaby also has done architecture, and like they're these crazy brick structures. And I was like, that would actually be a nice, like, I don't know if you could do those in brick, but you would get at that thing where you're turning the straight line into the curve linear, and if there was a way to sort of get those into brick, that would be.
And that comes out of, because you collaborated with Allison Gingeris on this recent exhibition on Cobra's work that's in New York right now, and so Julian, I mean, that Pierre Kirkaby work is in that show, right?
Or? Well, the paintings are in that show. The paintings, which are like much more in line with Cobra, that is where I came across it in that research for that show. I worked on the exhibition design for this show, Cobra, which is this group of Northern European artists after the war that many of them became key members of the Situationist International.
And then you lettrists, is so the kind of more literary
proclivities,
and then sort of Situationists. And then Constant with New Babylon and these kinds of utopian architecture projects.
Right.
So you're going to see a lot more of this in the next couple of years. I think there's two other major exhibitions in development around this work as well. That's what I meant about kind of the way in which you kind of go in and reactivate certain narratives or certain histories, right?
Yeah, well, and the working on the Cobra show took me to Aldo van Eyck, who was a Dutch architect who designed the first museum. He did the exhibition design of the first museum survey of Cobra. But before that, he had designed 700 playgrounds in Holland. And his connection to Cobra and then the Situationist was through this theory of homo ludens, which was like the role of the child and child creativity in culture. And so he's designing all these playgrounds. And of course, like that leads into these ideas about non-productive play and non-productive, you know, not sort of goal-oriented use of space. And yeah, it's super, I mean, super interesting to me, and yeah, certainly I stole things from Aldo van Eyck along the way of this show, yeah.
So one of the last points that I kind of wanted to make was, you know, again, thinking about this work is two last comments for me. Was to kind of think about in this current moment when images, and we talk about the sort of torrent of streams and images and things are sort of communicated through mimesis and imagery right now in photography. This is a show that begs a kind of slow unpacking, a slow reading that demands a kind of physical presence that I really have a new appreciation for coming after this. And the second point is what I started thinking about too is that Julian's putting out not new paradigms, right? Because I don't think we need a paradigm or enactment of a theory, but these terms that you're putting into play, the abject, mimesis, precariousness, other terms that are coming around, really shows that even if we don't get to this idea of a kind of technological goal or a kind of end point, a kind of progressive goal, but the idea that you're putting in dialogue a series of debates that I'm really looking forward to the next iteration of. So thank you very much. Thank you for all of you coming today.
Thank you.
It was really great.
Was it?